Well, hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Red Couch Theology Podcast. On this week's episode, we talk about the most delightful things like temptation and testing and Satan. So why don't you tune in and try and figure out how that's an exciting subject. Actually, I think it's really profound because Alex, I think, unlocks some of this part of the Lord's Prayer that is oftentimes confusing and challenging for us. Does God actually tempt us? Is that what he's up to behind the scenes? Is he dangling temptations in front of our face, wondering if we're going to stumble and fall? These are the kinds of questions we're going to wrestle with today. So let's dive in. Yeah. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Ready or not, we talked about the Count of Monte Cristo. We were talking about our personality. We were talking about Bitcoin.
Microphone.
Yeah. And Alex is talking about nothing, evidently, because he doesn't have a microphone.
If you have Tesla stock, Bitcoin, care for French novels from the revolutionary period or the Enneagram, the 10 minutes before the podcast was the podcast for you.
Yeah.
But unfortunately,
I had anything meaningful that you actually had something meaningful to say about the Count of Monte Cristo. I didn't.
Yeah. Well, having read it like 20 odd times, I feel like I'm more required to have learned something meaningful. It's got a huge time investment for me.
Just reading it once felt like both a joy and a sacrifice.
Yeah. This is why I get frustrated with audiobooks. I feel like I read way faster than I listen to audiobooks. Now, the beauty of an audiobook, of course, is that you can read it. I'm going to quote Mark as an anti-audiobook guy who's actually started to listen to audiobooks a lot more recently.
Yeah.
But you can read it while you're doing other things.
Yes.
But I always think that's an interesting dynamic between people that love to read and people that need to read or want to read.
Yeah.
So I love not doing anything but reading.
Yeah.
If I can take myself off and sit there, and there's actually this great Instagram reel that was around recently of a parent punishing a child that loves to read. And they're like, you're going to go and sit in your room and you won't be able to go out with your friends and you won't be able to do this.
All you can do is read a book.
Yeah, yeah. And the kid's like, I have to face that terrible consequence to my actions. Well, I will try and do it bravely.
Yippee!
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I think the reason I like audiobooks is twofold. One, I am not a fast reader.
Okay.
Super slow reader. I'm a pretty horrible reader, actually.
Yeah.
I think the other piece is I am a really good auditory learner.
Yes.
I retain more that I hear than that I read.
So that's my struggle, in that I actually think I'm a better auditory learner than I am learning from reading. Whatever the term is for that.
Visual?
Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I love books and reading so much that I still want to do it. But I podcasts just feel like they download information straight to me in a way that a book doesn't usually.
Yeah. Wild. Well, yeah, I do a lot. I probably do 80 or 90% of my quote-unquote reading in audio form, if possible.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And then, I've actually more recently committed to physically reading more because, partially because it actually slows me down.
Mm.
I feel like there's a different kind of learning.
Mm.
There's like the audio style, I can consume such large quantities of material. And it gives you like a better understanding of the overall argument or story arc or whatever when I do audio.
Yes.
But when I sit down and read, I can appreciate some of the very detailed nuances of something.
Yeah.
But I lose some of the, how did this chapter connect to the previous chapter?
Yeah. Well, let me segue us a little bit, but only a little bit. Because I think one of the temptations, keyword, of our modern society is centered around achievement. You have to show productivity.
Yeah.
And actually, there's just been some fascinating... Have you listened to or read any of Cal Newport stuff?
No.
So he wrote a book maybe 5 years ago called Deep Work, that for whatever reason, actually, even though he talks to like huge leadership groups, actually just became really popular with pastors.
Huh.
Like it was the book that pastors were reading, because he pushes this idea that like, get off the grid, like work consistent hours where nobody can contact you, where you're not flitting between thinking and like he actually really recognizes that there is a role that is somewhat, I think the term he'd use is you are a thought creative. Like your role is to think and to create through thinking.
Yeah.
And so his argument is that only happens when you create space for it to happen.
Yes.
So yeah. what he's started to push into, which just I love, I mean, he's really like been playing with some of my buttons, is he talks about slow productivity. So he said, like, try when you our American model is so centered around, oh yeah, work 8 hours and then make sure you work more than that.
Yeah.
Do your 40 hours a week and add to that. And if you're not working hard. But he's like, go back and look at some of these guys in history that have achieved the sort of things that you might like to achieve. And some of them, like, there's one author whose name I'm blanking on, but he says when he wrote this book, he had to write this book on a certain tree that's now like the go-to textbook on this tree. He said he lay on a picnic table for 15 hours and just stared at this tree. Now we go in our modern sense to that guy and we're like, he's kind of lazy today. He's not really doing anything.
Yeah.
Like, he's not productive. And yet we zoom out and we look at his life. He's one of the most prolific authors of all time.
Yeah.
Written 18 books, won a Pulitzer Prize, like done all of these different things.
Yeah.
So that, like, asking yourself, what am I trying to achieve rather than how many hours did I do, is actually a key thing.
Yeah. Well, which is actually one of the reasons why studies show introverts are so critical to society, because they do tend to give more space, they tend to protect more negative space in their lives.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And as a result, they also tend to produce more profound content.
Yeah.
Than a lot of extroverts might, because the extrovert fills their time up with a lot of activity and frenetic interactions and stuff. And fighting for that negative space. Fascinating. Yeah.
The some of the takeaway is like, well, if you're trying to be productive and you also are supposed to be on that day checking Slack, checking Asana, checking email, checking text messages, answering phone calls, don't expect to be a thoughtful creative. Which So it's just so interesting how our American society pulls us in a specific way.
Yeah.
And says, this is what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
And so we talked about temptation this week. Actually, temptation covers so much more than the limited term we would give it in the Christian world. Our language is a little bit more centered around, oh, did you find cash in an ATM?
Yeah.
Did you stare at an office worker a little bit too long?
Yeah.
All of those different things.
Yeah.
And yet it's so broad. Like, because so much of it is tied to our fear of self-rejection, the temptation, the draw to be significant, to be important, to achieve. So anyway, that was a segue
to temptation.
To temptation, where Jesus teaches us to pray, give us today our daily bread. No. Where did that come from? Teaches us to pray, lead us not into temptation. Can you just
deliver us from
that part? From the,
yeah,
part?
Well, we don't do any editing here. So all of our mistakes are out there for the world to see.
It's going to be there forever.
Well, what's funny is you got like the main subject matter perfect. Mm-hmm. We talked about temptation. You know the passage that says she just says, "Give me this today, this daily bread."
Oh, and I was like, "Yeah, I felt like someone online is going to diagnose me with something based on that." Either I'm worried about my bread.
Well, I will just say, well, one, I think pretty quickly, I need to. Although maybe the biggest complainers already talked to you on Sundays, but we do want to know whether you took the money from the ATM.
Actually got complainers on Sunday.
Yes.
And multiple text messages just throughout the week of people saying, like, I knew that they were with their small groups just based on the times that they were texting and stuff like that. It's just like they're discussing Sunday and now they're like, we need closure on this story. So let me say this, because I know it can be frustrating, but actually the not completing the story is very intentional. Because as soon as I complete my story in something like that, and I've had the same complaints. I told a story about my dad falling off a scaffolding. I told a story about somebody getting sick. Like, there's been quite a few of these. As soon as I complete my story, the immediate response of someone is to begin judging how I acted in the story. So if I take the money, the actual takeaway is, oh, Alex wasn't a great person in that respect at that point.
Yeah.
Hopefully he's become better. Or if I gave the money back, the temptation is to begin to say, oh, Alex is a better guy than we thought he was. We expected him to take it. Or... you know, so
and completing the story has an answer. Yeah.
Well, then it stops them actually putting themselves in the story. So the goal of a story like that is actually much easier in some ways to, I could have looked up a journal article and said, oh, based on this one unrepeatable study from the University of whatever, only 35% of people who find money on the street hand it in. And that number's different based on this nation and this nation and this nation. But that doesn't get the, like, the, in Jesus' word, the, like, the spaglicnon, the gut moving.
Yeah.
Whereas all of us can imagine walking past an ATM and there's just a stack of cash there.
Yeah.
And get to some of the feelings. So actually it forces them to actually, instead of knowing my story, it actually forces them, if they're paying attention anyway, to start to think, well, what would I do in that situation?
Yeah.
Which is far more useful.
Yeah, I can see that. That makes that you make a good case for that. I had a preaching professor say, "Don't you dare ever not finish the story because you'll lose your audience."
I think he's wrong. But there we go.
That's, yeah, exactly.
That's why I didn't get very good marks in preaching class.
Well, he was just like, "Well, if you want them to focus on the subject after the story, they might just wander off and wonder that for the rest of the message."
And so, but isn't this?
But I don't know which one's right. But that's a good case for it.
But isn't it interesting as well? Like, yes, if your goal is to get them to listen to everything you say, which I might argue in a 21st century audience that's used to scrolling Twitter and taking, like, you know, 7-second sound bites or video bites, that might be impossible now, increasingly. So is your goal to have them listen to everything you say and value it and maybe on some level imbibe it? Or is your goal for something to stick and the spirit to be able to work on them throughout the week? So it might be that actually an uncompleted story around an ATM and cash forced people to come back to it more times than they would have done had I got their full attention for 40 minutes, which just statistically is not possible.
Yeah.
40 minutes of attention is not a doable thing for a modern human being. 15 minutes is good.
Yeah.
So I think to me, I was like, I always feel like the tension is, I'll sacrifice almost anything in a sermon for tension. If I think about it, like when it comes down to it.
Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah. So, I don't know. I don't know if I had an opinion on it. I don't know. Because I think you make a good case for it.
Yeah,
but I also, it messes with my head when people come up and comment on something that had nothing to do with the main idea that I was talking about.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, did you hear the rest of it? You know, so then it, I don't know.
And sometimes like that actual process of like, what do I do with that is the main point.
Yeah. For sure. If it is, then it makes a ton of sense. If that's all that sticks, then hey, great. You sort of accomplish your goal, even if they don't remember the 3 points later that was some sub point or whatever that was less significant.
Yeah.
So, well, now, there you go, folks. I did my part. I asked him. He did not take the money. He is a better person than we thought he was.
Did I actually answer in the end? I did say that, right? I didn't take the money, yeah. Did I?
You did take the money?
No, I didn't take the money.
You did not take the money.
Yeah,
I did. Did you answer?
I don't know if I did.
But you told me because I asked you on Sunday. Yeah. He did not take the money.
I did not take the money. I took it into the bank, and the guy that had tried to get the money out, the machine had short circuited in the same way I did, 4 or 5 minutes ago, and just nothing had happened, and he bashed on it a few times and tried to get it to come out, and nothing happened. So he'd gone into the bank. The ATM was outside the branch.
Yeah.
And while he was inside, the money had ejected.
Okay. So he was actually there. So then you were like a double hero. You weren't just an anonymous hero. You were a double hero.
I got to stand face to face with the guy whose money I handed over. And he was just so, I mean, because I don't know what would have happened had I not given it back. Like, they would never have found me, even if they had a camera. It's not like I had a profile. I was 19 years old. I would have disappeared off. Into the wherever.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he would have got his money back.
But, and then is there a legal precedence when money's just sticking
out? Yeah, I don't know.
Like,
is that
it's crime? Not like you hacked into his thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
I'm not sure what I would have done. I'm pretty sure I'm a worse person than you think I am, everyone out there. I'm increasingly confident that I'm worse.
So anyway, he very sweetly said, can I send you a check to say thank you? And I said, no, you don't need to do that. I wished afterwards I'd said, could you send a check to this charity that I love or something like that? But
yeah.
It was one of those stories that you just walked away from and actually hadn't thought about for a couple of decades.
Yeah.
And then when I started to think through
illustrations of this,
of temptation, I was like, oh man, that might be just what I'm looking for at the start.
Yeah.
Because it also meant I got to joke about getting haircuts as well, which
was, double win.
Little bit of fun.
Little
bit of fun.
That's great. We talked about temptation, not bread.
Mm-hmm.
And can you give us a summary of the direction you took this? Because if you weren't there Sunday, I encourage you to go back and listen to it because here's why. I'll make my case and I'll try to do this without puffing up Alex's head too much. But I feel like this was maybe the best sermon I've heard on this particular text, because it is probably one of the hardest one or wackiest verses in the Lord's Prayer, in my opinion.
Yeah, and
because you're instantly like wrestling with like other passages where God definitely doesn't tempt us, and you're interesting, and even if it was like, even if you translate the word, don't test us. Does God really test us like that? And then...
Well, I think that's the thing.
Do we have the audacity to tell him not to test us? If God wants to test us, then we should be tested, right? Mm. And like, oh, it just starts to create all this weird, strange, like emotional stuff for me.
I absolutely think it's the verse in the Lord's Prayer that gets emotionally bypassed the most often.
Yeah, it's like...
Other than maybe the ones you did, because those can become a little bit of a, well, I can't see that, I can't... That's not personal.
Yeah.
So,
It's one of those ones that I think that people might read it, they might pray it, but it's like, it doesn't necessarily sit with them as a beautiful invitation of prayer. Mm. It's like, okay, that's weird. Moving on, next verse.
So beautifully, I think, just a little note on the whole of the Lord's Prayer. I mean, you did a wonderful job talking through the first couple of verses. The next verses, they are all about interpersonal relationships. But they are all verses that say, God, your kingdom coming, your will being done, let it be done in me personally.
Yeah.
You know, and us as individuals. Like, so it's that invite. So theoretically, you are saying when you say lead us not into temptation or do not let us be led into temptation, depending on how you play with the word, you're saying, God, help me to live a life that looks like the life that sees your kingdom come. In whatever small part I play, you know, there's actually commentators that tie it directly to that first verse and say, this is part of you saying, I want to be the person that lives the life that brings the kingdom.
Yeah.
So that in itself ties it. So, because it is a weird end, isn't it? You can see why someone at some point added,
for thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory.
Because it's just like, oh, and lead us not into temptation and deliver us from evil. Done. It's
the last word of the Lord's Prayer is the word evil.
Yeah. Very strange. So it's almost like it's stark. It's almost just cuts off. And so a flowery second announcement of kingdom.
Yeah.
Seems like it fits. So I actually think I actually love it when I would pray it as it is privately. And if I had my way, I think I'd pray it with the other ending as a community. Because I think it actually invites some kind of transition back to worship in a way that deliver us from evil doesn't quite do. So yeah. I'm quite in favor of the other end in some ways. So what I tried to do at the start with this one to give people into a window, it was one where I felt like I really wanted to do whatever I could to build the tension and kind of mess with us in terms of if God is implicit in temptation, theoretically it means he's implicit in these particular ways of temptation or ways that we see temptation.
Yeah.
So if God is implicit in cash in an ATM tempting poor students, does that mean he's also implicit in dens of sin or whatever you'd call them on the side of the road that attract poor travelers?
Yeah.
Gambling dens, brothels, all those places. When you walk down the road and see a billboard with half-naked woman, half-naked guy on it, like is that God tempting? When you think about kids in poverty in Somalia and a ship loaded with goods sails past, is that God tempting pirates to feed their children?
I love the tension building pieces of a message. You know, again, this getting in the semantics of preaching, but yeah, you're right. Like at the end of that section, which I think you extended a little bit longer and you lingered there, you actually. It's almost like you made such a strong case that God would be implicated if that's what this meant, that like by the time you actually pivoted to the content of the message, we're like, oh no, God's in trouble.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
So you got us to that place where we're like, oh, how's Alex going to dig out of this hole that he just dug? Yeah.
And the final one was actually supposed to switch the mentality. So it's like, imagine yourself in these situations. Imagine yourself as a, you know, well, most of us don't have to work to imagine ourselves as someone who's tempted by a sexual sin. Like that's pretty common to a lot of humanity. Most of us, you know, we can try and put ourselves in the place of a parent watching their child go hungry, but we haven't been there. The final one was supposed to switch our perspective and hopefully give us a window into ways that we operate like a tempter as opposed to someone who is tempted.
What was the final one?
So the final one was being a fisherman. And I was talking about how I fish with a lure. I'm too ADD to fish with a float. You just sit there. So I'd probably love fly fishing as well. I've just never actually done it.
Because it's pretty active, yeah.
But the goal of a lure is that you, where we fish up at Laura's folks' lake house, There's lots of like little like strips of rock or rocks, and the bigger fish tend to hide in amongst them. And so what you're doing is you're trying to cast this lure that looks somewhat like a fish they would hunt, and you're supposed to mimic the speed of that fish. And it's designed to swim a little bit like an injured fish or a sick fish. And the fish is conned into striking. And then finds themselves on a hook.
Yeah.
And so that gives us like a picture of like, oh, I know what it is to try and get. And is that what God is doing? Is he skillfully playing the lure because his goal is to get human beings to bite.
Yeah.
And then say, ha, got you. Because if you just read, lead us not into temptation, believing that God is the one that does that, there's no other alternative.
Yeah.
And so then...
And you, even if you say it's a test, you're like, well, yeah, okay, it's a test, but it's a really hard test.
Yeah,
it's
really like a really hard test. Yeah.
Like an almost unfair test, you know? Like
yeah.
You get a college-level exam to a seventh grader or something, and you're like, go for it. And they're like, I failed the test.
Yeah.
Shocker.
Yeah. And so all the verses in the Lord's Prayer, like especially the second half, have some translation questions. You know, we talked about that with, you know, about a third of the congregation grew up praying, forgive us our debts. About a third grew up praying, forgive us our trespasses. A third grew up praying, forgive us our sins.
Yeah.
So that's got some like struggles with literal, and then how do you gloss the literal translation when it doesn't work, when an idiom doesn't translate? And idioms are notoriously complicated. They root in a culture. If I was to say to an American, oh, we looked across the road and there was Old Glory painting the breeze.
Yeah.
Most Americans might get that.
Yeah.
But go to India and say it and nobody gets that, even if you can translate it literally.
Yeah.
So idioms are hard. This one out of all of them has the most translation issue because temptation and tempt are the same word. Temptation and test are the same word.
In Greek, yeah.
In Greek. And we absolutely know that they're not in English. We don't even feel like they're the same.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tempt has a pejorative.
I think it also theologically... You go to other passages and it even makes it more confusing.
Yes.
Because you have James that says, like, he does not tempt.
Uh-huh.
Unequivocally, like, dead. And then Jesus, who theoretically could trump James, says, lead us not into temptation.
Yeah.
But wait a minute. Yeah, James promised.
Yeah.
James, you let me down. You promised that he would never do this. And so you run into a prayer like this. And if you're at all exposed to the scriptures and ideas in the scriptures, you're a little bit like, I must not be understanding it. And for most people, they might just say, I must not get it and move on.
Yeah.
And yeah.
And so you can see why for people that sit in church regularly that want something to be simple, which I think is a surprising number of people, if we're honest at times, like, can it just be plain? Unfortunately, anytime you're translating what somebody said in one language and then somebody wrote in another language into a third language that has changed multiple times over hundreds of years, you're never going to get simple. I can totally get why some. Did we talk the other day about the clip of the Baptist pastor of this tiny little church who's like, he's so King James only. He's like, I can correct the Greek with my King James Bible. Like, he's just like, absolutely, like, this text is the one. And you can see why somebody might like to go there. You can see why in Islam they have taken the Quran and they've decided on a version and they've destroyed the other version. And so now there's an official version that has no
question marks.
No question marks, no competition.
Yeah.
Whereas we've got hundreds of versions of the Bible and it feels like a new one appears every couple of years.
Yeah, and usually theological debates are even more complicated because if you're doing a good job at it, you're eventually going to get down to translation challenges.
Yeah.
And so you're like, man, it would just be helpful if we could just almost ditch the old versions or like settle on one so that we could have the unequivocal tiebreaker between all these things.
Actually, yeah, absolutely. So I was actually going to look up if I remember, So the RSV, so if you go and read the different versions, the Revised Standard Version, that does say, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. So the big three translation questions word-wise, everyone would agree that this is a leading language. It's a journey language.
Yep.
It's future orientated. It's as we continue on the way, do something for us.
Yeah.
But
so this part's pretty, this section here is pretty.
Well, lead has a little bit of, like, it's the into and lead. Lead now, so lead has some translation questions because lead can be causative or it can be passive. We talked about that.
It's
does God take us there or does he just allow us to go there? We know exactly what that means when we talk about raising children. Like, we do this all the time.
Yep.
It's like, I'm gonna allow you into a space that may have some risks, but I'm not taking you there. But then at other times, no, I specifically brought you here for this purpose. So that, like, we kind of get that sense. But it does change the tenor of the passage. Temptation is a big question, and evil one is a big question, because it could easily read test. It could easily read just evil. And so you can go through, I picked like 50 different versions and go through, and like a bunch of them will say test, a bunch of them will say temptation. And then the split between evil one and evil is even more like 50-50. About half of them finishing evil, about half of them finishing the evil one.
Yep.
And how you translate those, it matters. It changes the feel.
Yep.
Is God just allowing you into spaces of testing? And are you asking him to deliver you from general evil? That's maybe the one extreme. Or is God actively leading you into places that might tempt you away from his will and protecting you at the same time from a devil figure who is a distinct person with distinct goals?
Yeah.
And how are they not the same in some ways, or how are they not working for the same goals, if that's how you read it? Like, yeah. I mean, it's really hard.
Really, really hard. And so you actually, you exegeted the text, you explained individual words. We don't need to rehash all those details, but I would encourage you, if you want those details, Alex makes the case for a certain way of reading this, and then he summarized that case with his own translate, like an interpretive translation of the verse in sort of modern language. Could you give us that?
So I definitely can. And I would say, I also wanted to get across the fact that this is a verse distinctly tied to presence. So you can tie this verse, you know, and put it alongside verses like Matthew 28, where Jesus says, "And lo, I am with you always to the end of the age." You can put it alongside verses like Psalm 23, "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you are with me." This is a verse that is not only a journey verse, but it is a journey alongside God verse.
Yeah.
And that fits beautifully with where we've been in the Lord's Prayer. I mean, if you think about those more personal aspects.
Yeah.
Give us today our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive those that have debts against us, and lead us not into temptation. It covers the full gamut of the recognition that we need provision, we need forgiveness, and we need you to be with us, because without you, life doesn't look the way we want it to look.
Yeah.
So I finished with this, and I'll just give you the whole version, the whole sentence right now. If I can find it.
I should have put it my computer so I could put it on the screen, but that's okay.
I finished with, "Be with us on this journey full of trials. Keep us faithful to your way and protect us from the one who would do us harm." So I started with, "On this journey full of trials, keep us faithful to your way." That, to me, is a good summary of the heartbeat of "lead us not into temptation."
Yeah. So, I think that some of the aha moments for me were, this one, you made the case that essentially, you know, God is not implicit in this like more active
always
way.
Yeah. Sometimes. So, I mean, there's language in places like Moses, it specifically says there's some testing. Abraham, there's some testing. So it's sometimes you need that.
Yes. But the prayer that applies in either case is like, life's hard.
Yes, totally.
And when it's hard, help me to stay in step with you and not convert that hard into sin.
Yeah, and why?
I might have a propensity to take the hard things of life and actually double down on sin in response to those hard things.
Yeah.
This is a request for God to prevent that from happening.
Yes.
Because God's intention, whether he's actively testing or whether he just is allowing us to be exposed to challenging things, his intention is always to produce
yes.
life and goodness from the from that thing.
And think about how we, you know, if you've got kids, you understand this. Think about how we create tests in order to replicate potential situations in the real world, like to teach something that may need to be known or have done before when it comes up organically. In England, I don't think you guys do it here, but in England, one of the big moments you're waiting for in a driving test is the emergency stop. At some point, the driving instructor who sat next to you will bang on the dashboard, and you have to stop the car quickly and safely. Like, there's some rules for it, yet the car has to not stall. It's usually a manual transmission. You have to not veer off the road. You have to keep both hands on the wheel. You have to maintain full control of the car.
Yeah.
The goal is that at some point in your life, you might have to stop the car quickly and safely because of something that happens on the road. So that instantly gives us an easy example of why it seems that God puts us in situations at times that we'll need to learn something from. Why does David in the Old Testament end up fighting lions and bears and all of these different animals? Because sometime later he's going to fight Goliath.
Yeah.
So that helps us with that language, I think.
Yeah.
Sometimes tests are preparation. Sometimes we're learning something. And the heartbeat seems to be, yeah, because life is crazy hard at times.
Yeah.
And sometimes you need to know some stuff and have dealt with some stuff to get there. And whether God led you into it or whether it came up organically, anytime you're in a difficult situation, a great question is to ask, like, what is this teaching me? What am I learning? What might God be asking me to learn in this moment?
Yeah.
So that kind of helps us, I think, with that language. Lead us not into trials.
And then the second half of the statement has to do with this, like, protection.
Yeah.
Because God has a positive agenda for the hard things of life in, uh-huh. in your world. But the devil uh-huh. or even just your own sin nature, like if you want to make it more evil in general.
Yes.
Evil also has an agenda.
Yeah, I would say for this translation, like so far in Matthew, this term has come up a few times. It's always been translated the evil one, the man or evil man mm-hmm. up until this point. I think a good way of saying it is like first, like translation might be the devil specifically, and then secondary, like other people intent on causing evil. And then just thirdly, the broken world that seems to conspire to ruin.
And that's
as true as, like, you know, my mom was saying to me the other day, she was talking about her grandma, and she said her grandma specifically prayed, God, please let me keep all of my marbles, in an English idiom. Like, please help me
yeah.
to not get to that point where I can no longer think for myself.
Yeah.
And her body became broken, but she kept that faculty her entire life.
Like, yeah.
That might be a prayer that works in this situation. Does it get answered all the time? Doesn't seem so. But that maybe is the third piece of that. So it gives you that sense of, yeah, it's talking about all three of those things probably in that order. And then finally, so I tried to take those two pieces, the place of trial, the place that feels dangerous, the place yeah. that feels where you're vulnerable, and potentially people around you or a person around you that wants to do you harm, and tried to put that into story form through an example of my time in Haiti.
Yeah.
And just the distinct feeling. Now, I don't know that anybody wanted to do me harm in that setting.
Yeah.
But I did become deeply aware that I was different to everyone around me. I experienced the vulnerability that lots of people of color like experience in this country at times.
Yeah.
That I was rich in terms of the space I was in. That I must have looked somewhat like a ship sailing off the coast of Somalia.
Yeah.
And that all of my mechanisms to keep myself safe had been removed. The armed driver was gone. The lockable doors were gone, with the curtains that you could draw over the windows that stayed on the safe roads, even though at the time nothing was particularly safe in Haiti.
Yeah.
And suddenly I was in a back street with one Haitian guy that I'd learned to trust.
Yeah.
Who theoretically struggled with the same poverty issues that the other people around him did. And recognized my own vulnerability.
Yeah.
There was nothing to stop Samuel in that moment, pulling up the car, pushing me out of the passenger seat into the middle of the road and saying, guys, let's split the cash.
Yeah.
And so knowing that I trusted him, but having this urge to say something like, Samuel, like, is this the right place?
Yeah.
And then perhaps something like, you know, I'm relying on you here, right?
Yeah.
Don't lead me into spaces we're not supposed to be.
Yeah.
And make sure nobody else harms me. And really all of that might be summarized in like, Samuel, I'm so glad you're here. Like, you are making a difference just by being here.
Yeah.
And that hopefully gives like this tiny window into the sense of presence that comes with this verse. Because I think most of us, like I think most of us are quite comfortable with trials when we know God is with us. And that's always the hard element, I think, to maintain. If you think about your future and think about the things you're scared of, and then try and decide, do I see God present with me in those moments? Most of us, we've forgotten to add him into the equation.
Yeah.
We might know he's present now, but we don't see him present with us in the future.
Yeah, if you've come to the place in your life where you trust the character of God, then yes.
Yes.
And, you know, we would make the case that you can implicitly trust the character of God because most of us are comfortable. Like, it makes the trials have more hope and meaning and helps us muscle through those trials to know that God is with us and actively trying to produce good in those moments on our behalf.
And I went to visit a member of our community this week, and he's, you know, going into an assisted living space, and I was trying to put myself in his situation. And I'm like, oh my goodness, God, if I go through this, do I believe you are with me? Because trying to feel it from my position, it doesn't feel like that.
Yeah.
And yet, this prayer isn't situation. It's not affected by situation. It's like a faith statement, isn't it, at the same time?
Yeah. So maybe it'd be beneficial, because we didn't get any questions this week.
Other than, what did you do with the cash?
Yeah, what'd you do? Are you a good person or are you a bad person?
I want to know. I want to see into your soul.
Yeah. I want to know whether I should judge you or not. I think it might be beneficial to just zoom back out on the whole Lord's Prayer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've already made the observation both explicitly and implicitly all throughout this section of the series on the Lord's Prayer. But it's like, I think that over and over again, you've mentioned that this is a prayer of like just significant surrender. It's such a vulnerable prayer all throughout. It's like, how would you summarize the Lord's Prayer, the heartbeat of the Lord's Prayer, maybe in other words than surrender?
Yeah. So I think, and this is, I mean, it's very tied to surrender, I guess, but it's a trust prayer. It's a prayer that says that what God says about the world is more accurate than what we see around us. Because our fear is, if I don't work enough, there's not enough bread. I mean, you see this all the time with like, you know, why am I working 70 hours a week? Well, because I'm fighting the system. I'm trying to make sure there's enough. And to actually get to a point of saying, this was the very problem the children of Israel faced Like, there's bread on the ground. I'm going to pick up more than I need. And it never lasted. It like, you know, and Ecclesiastes taps into all of that. It's almost like it paints wealth as something that slides through the fingers.
Yeah.
Can't ever be grasped. You can't ever get enough. So that element is about trust. The forgiveness, we've had so many conversations about this, you and I have, about, well, we even slightly disagree, maybe, like, what does it mean to pray, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors? Like, is it to throw out the system of measurement altogether? Or is it to simply hand it over to God and say, God, you'll bring justice? Like, are we actually asking for them to be let off the hook? Or are we just handing over the... Certainly in Psalms, it's a handing over of the justice. Yeah. Like, my question is, does Jesus nudge us beyond that? And so...
But either way, it's a surrender.
Yeah.
It's giving up our right,
yes,
to justice.
And
either we hand the scepter of justice to God, or we just say there is no scepter.
Yes,
and both of them feel very disorienting.
Yeah, it's and that is about. I used to think fairness was something unique to me for a while. Like, I'm so obsessed with it, but actually, as I read. No, it's a universal thing. Like, you can take a thief who steals people's stuff, and you can quickly sneak into a parking spot before he gets there. You know, he's been waiting for this spot, and you grab the spot quickly. And it's like, that's not fair. It's like he's appealing to fairness. A guy who takes other people's stuff has his own metric for what is fair and what isn't.
Yeah, and if you were to steal from him, that wouldn't be fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have our sense of what we think is fair, and it's our own measure.
Yeah.
And this actually says, let that go, because you don't want fair. Like, fair sucks. And the grace of God is not fair. So that, like, it's got this counterintuitive nature to it. And then the temptation piece to trust that God will lead us appropriately into spaces sometimes that are hard, and that he's with us. And sometimes just the world is hard and he's with us, and that sometimes it feels like there's a roaring lion that's about to devour, and he says, no, trust me to defend you. So all of them are counterintuitive. They are all like seeing the world different than it physically appears to be.
Yeah.
But it begins in those terms, because to pray your kingdom come, if we're honest, do we really believe in the kingdom coming? Do we really believe this world could ever be shaped around who God is and be controlled by him and under his influence?
Yeah, I think that maybe this is why, I don't even know how to articulate this. It's like the seed of a thought. I'm not going to say salvation is progressive. What I'm going to say is, like, the journey of faith, maturation inside of Christianity, or sanctification would be another term, a more Christianese term, is a progressive growing into trusting the character and the goodness of God.
Yeah.
Because which is where the prayer starts.
Mm-hmm.
Father.
Mm-hmm.
If you actually believe he's a father and a good one, then the rest of the prayer can work.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't trust his character, I'm not willing to leave my bread in the hands of this unknown, mm-hmm. invisible entity in the mm-hmm. sky. I'm not willing to let go of mm-hmm. justice and hand it to this unknown entity in the sky.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I'm not willing to be led into places of hardness mm-hmm. and trust that this unknown entity invisible in the sky is going to, like, it takes an implicit trust to go on this journey. And I think that in God's patience and kindness, he's constantly, like, he might say, okay, let's talk about this issue in your life.
Uh-huh.
And it's going to take a little bit of trust. You're like, okay, you were faithful with this. Now I'm going to relinquish my trust in this new area of my life. and see how it goes. And then he turns out he's right and he's good and mm-hmm. he's on the right track in your life. And then he brings up another issue in your life. You're like, oh, I'm not sure I'm ready to trust you with that one. Mm-hmm. But over and over again, he proves himself faithful. It's constant surrender.
And if you feel like it's hard to do that, know that it's always been hard. I'm always, one of the stories that always just has piqued my interest has been, you know, when in the Exodus narratives, when Moses is up on the mountain, the people down below with Aaron alongside them gather all the gold and they build the golden calf.
Yeah.
Now, my original reading of that as a kid was, well, they built a new God. But actually, when you go back to the story, they actually build the golden calf. And then Aaron says, this is Yahweh that led us out of Egypt. So they didn't change their God.
They just made a
they
representation.
They just needed him to be physically present with them.
Yeah.
And Jesus wrestles with that with his disciples. You know, he says, you know, I will be with you even though you won't see me anymore.
Yeah.
All of those things, that thing, that wrestling with a physical God being present with us has been a struggle for centuries, millennia. We wrestled with this when we did Acts as a church. I gave people the pithy line that wasn't original to me, but the idea that Jesus teaches us that the Spirit inside us is greater than him beside us.
Yeah.
But it's hard to believe.
It is.
And so
mainly because it'd be one thing to make the thought exercise, but we're banking on the fact that we're going to make counterintuitive decisions based according to what the world would say.
Yeah.
The world says the good life, uh-huh. the way you should be as a human being is this direction.
Yeah.
And we're saying, according to Jesus, the good way of being human is this direction.
Yeah.
And we're banking on this invisible thing to say, I'm swimming upstream.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm just trusting that he's right.
Yes. Yeah. The world doesn't say get enough. It says get more.
Yeah.
The world says get even. The world says get away from trials.
Yeah.
And Jesus says something very different.
Yeah.
And so some of what, when we talk about this leading us forward into the future, is recognizing that there will come a point. C.S. Lewis does this beautifully at the end of Screwtape Letters. There's the final letter where the patient dies. And I just reread this again recently. But there's this moment where the tempter Screwtape, or the uncle of the tempter, the evil one, is talking through what he knows the man experienced. And he says, how well I know that final, like, blinding light, where suddenly he sees you, the tempter, and knows the part that you've had and knows that you have it no longer. And then he sees them and knows that he's always known them, that he suddenly knows the part each of them has played in his life, the times that they've been there when he felt something but didn't know how to describe it. And that finally, yes, he sees him, the one who died for him, the one who gave his life for him. And he said, and he says, you know, you would love to see he's falling on the floor, groveling as pain and suffering, but it's not. It's him embracing real life. It's just such a beautiful ending to the narrative.
Yeah.
And just captures what one day we'll know about all of these things.
Yeah.
We'll know the ways that we thought we needed more and actually had enough. The ways that we thought we were right to get even and actually were invited to get free. And we'll know the trials that we were led into, that we were accompanied through. And we'll know the presence of the one who never left us, who was with us in those moments.
Yeah.
Who makes the difference.
Yeah, I kind of envision these moments where you know, the scriptures tell us in Corinthians 13 that for now we see in a mirror dimly.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the veil's lifted and you're sort of like, oh, there's these old spirituals that say like, we'll understand it all by and by.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be these moments where you're like, oh God, you're such a genius.
Mm-hmm.
In the moment, I hated that.
Yeah.
And now that I see all the variables at play, there's no way I would have come up with that genius solution to allow this particular temptation or challenge. Or, oh man, I'm so glad you didn't come through with the money that I asked for in this moment. Because if you had, I would have made this decision and then I would have fallen into this sin and then that would have ended up in this relationship. And you're like, I feel like I don't know for you, like when I encounter a great piece of literature, a narrative or a great movie, and the narrator or the author of this script or book just masterfully says something and you're like, that is just like great articulation of something. I feel like all of eternity will be discovering those moments as you look back in the past and you discover God's wisdom and kindness all throughout history. You're just gonna be like, ah, well played.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, again, well played. Oh, great job on that one.
And that we're also aware that eternity must have something like...
some discovery.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you'll have both of those. You'll be like, okay, how are we going to encounter this? Okay. The wisdom and the kindness of God. Yeah.
Beautiful stuff.
Awesome. Well, I highly recommend, if you didn't get a chance to listen this last week, I think it took this passage, this particular verse of the Lord's Prayer, and brought it to life for me. And I love the Lord's Prayer. Best text ever.
Mm-hmm.
But this particular one was more shrouded for me in confusion than I would have liked. And your message really helped me. So, and if it helped me, if I vote for it, then you should probably vote for it too. Because that's how I work. If it's my favorite, it should be everyone's favorite.
So this week we'll return to Jesus 3. I mean, this has all been under Jesus' triad of spiritual disciplines that have to be practiced with a specific intention.
Yeah.
So we go back to the third one, which is fasting.
I think you should eat a sandwich while talking about fasting.
I did think about that. I actually thought about...
Because the other day we were talking about fasting and you were eating a burrito.
Yeah.
And I don't know why there was like all this dissonance for me. I was like, I can't even take this seriously while you chomp on that burrito.
I actually thought about laying out like my kitchen and all the ways that I just casually just like gorge myself in a bad mood. I'm like, I've got a bag of mini eggs that I'm just like slowly destroying. And like, oh man.
All right. On that confusing note, bye.
Bye.